Welcome to the Memories of a Moonbird podcast, exploring life one story at a time. Hello, friends. Today on the show, wow, what an incredible human being. He's a global resilience design consultant. What does that mean? We're going to find out. He's also an educator, lecturer, and storyteller who's worked in North America, Africa, the Middle East, Europe, and Australia. For over 30 years, he's worked in agroecological education and regenerative system design for communities, private and public organizations, households, farms, and conservation properties worldwide. He's the co-founder of Quail Springs Permaculture Wilderness Youth Project, True Nature Design Consulting, and is an advising founder of the Permaculture Research Institute of Kenya. His efforts with youth globally include working with former child soldiers in West Africa, teaching organic gardening skills with refugee families, and inspiring inner-city youth to discover their inherent gifts through unique education programs that inspire a connection to nature and to themselves. I'm honored to welcome the incredible Mr. Warren Brush. Warren, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Daniel, for having me. It's an honor to be here, and I look forward to our conversation.
Me too. Let's start in with, where are you from?
Where am I from? Well, it depends on how big of a scale, planet Earth, but I grew up in Santa Cruz Mountains, a little town called Felton, California, but I was born in Pasadena, but didn't live there very long. I did have a big influential time in Pasadena when I was 2 to 3 years old, where my great-grandmother used to care for me while my parents were working and going to school, and she had an amazing garden in the backyard, and she raised her own chickens, and she was in her 90s in the mid-1960s when I was born. So, you know, I come from places, but I also come from people.
Well, that's beautifully led into my first question, which was going to be, did you grow up loving nature? And obviously you did. That's really incredible. Yeah. Was there a particular experience in your youth that was profound that led you into wanting to work in nature?
You know, we moved from Pasadena, and my Grandma Grant, I think, was the original little old lady from Pasadena, by the way, because she was definitely that. But we moved from there to this amazing edge-of-the-woods place called Felton, California. Mm. There's incredible redwood forest there, rivers and streams. And so my influence as a child was so formulated by the redwood forest ecology. And so I can't say particularly there was one instance that formulated my love of the natural world and my desire to serve the natural world. I just feel that it was part of the patterning that I was exposed to. And in my belief, and also in seeing many different studies around what formulates worldviews, one of the things that one study talks about the two largest influences of our worldviews, and one is sensory input, and the other is mind focus. Mm. So whatever you're exposed to starts to formulate your worldview. So I feel like growing up on the edge of the woods and spending my afternoons in the woods just frolicking. And, you know, I used to put a stick upstream and then follow it for miles down. And
yeah, I had a very similar upbringing in Ohio. We grew up in very small towns in the Midwest, and I was always surrounded by woods. We always had woods in our backyard. It was a lot of hiking and playing in nature. And so that's where I developed my passion and love for it as well. That's great.
Yeah.
I'm curious, did you travel a lot as a kid?
No. I had a few trips my family did. It was, you know, driving and in a Volvo station wagon to Canada and back up the coast in a rainy season. And
to Vancouver or?
Yeah,
like
up
that?
To Vancouver. And then we visited family in Washington. That was one of the biggest trips I'd taken. And then did a trip with my dad to Atlanta, Georgia and to Florida. And that was like the big trip, first time on a plane, that type of thing. And so I never really traveled extensively until I was in my early 20s.
Your career path shows a great deal of empathy for humanity and the earth itself. And I'm curious, is there a Reader's Digest kind of shorter version of your journey, that how you went from a boy in the woods to this world traveler who's helping preserve and save the environment and all of us who live in it?
I moved out of the house when I was 16. It's a long story. My parents went through a journey that they lost all of their monetary resources. We were raised very upper middle class, and my mom and dad lost, you know, everything and went into debt. And we were literally living on friends' sofas. And, you know, it was this crazy from having a home raised with an indoor pool. And like, it was just a whole different world. But it was probably the best thing that ever happened to us. And right around that time, my grandfather, who I really, really looked up to, he was kind of an edge dweller in the world. And for many of his years, he was a commercial fisherman and would go for months out into the ocean and travel, and a truck driver. And he just had all these adventures. And at one point in his life, he and my grandma decided that he would stop traveling and he would stop doing the things of his heart, so to speak, and get an office job so he would be home for the kids. And it just about killed him. He reverted to alcoholism and he basically, they said that we're going to take the trip of a lifetime when we retire. We're going to go all around the world. We're going to see all these things. And the day you retire, we can leave. So, you know, we kept hearing these stories. It got to the point where he retired from an office job at a trucking company and the next day went back to clean out his desk and he died of a heart attack.
Oh my God.
And he had tickets 3 days later to go to Tahiti. He was going to be there for 6 months with his brother. And he just, they had all this stuff planned. And I was 14 at the time. And it so shocked me into this like deep belief that you don't live your life for a moment years in the distance, but you really look at what is the experiences that I'm writing as my life as I go along. And yeah. You know, I don't want to end up on my deathbed and just say, you know, I haven't done the things that I was called to do or that I'm destined to do.
Yeah, I was gonna say, at what age do you think you finally went, ah, this is what I'm meant to do?
33.
I'm called to
33. Yeah. My desire, like at that point, was really working with youth and trying to inspire them to have awareness of the natural world. So there was a lot came together around that time, but there was a big journey in between that led me down the track of animal tracking.
Very cool.
So, and that was something that started to find a passion. It's like looking at natural patterns in the world around us and actually seeing stories in the tracks in the sand and seeing how patterns basically make up our entire life. And that then led to this time of finding where my gifts aligned with that, which led into permaculture.
You grew up in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
What are the biggest differences in life today between life back then, do you think?
Well, I think often of how, you know, I would call a friend with my landline and my friend would pick up with a landline on his phone and we would say, let's meet in town. And so we would ride our bikes to town, to the big town of Felton, California, and we would come into town. But if we didn't find each other at the right moment, we just didn't get on our phone and say, hey, I'm here. But we had to find each other. We had to like navigate differently without technology.
Yeah.
And so what I found for me a big difference is the one is the mind focus piece right now is very different than when I was a child. So remember I was saying the two most significant influences of worldview formation is sensory input and the other is mind focus. So now I find the mind focus has shifted so much from where as a kid you were in the 60s and 70s, I was having to focus my mind on the world outside of me and the natural world and the multitude of patterns and the incredible diversity and complication of natural patterns. And now today, kids are focusing on binary flashes of light in screens for hours and hours on end in the day. And I find that it's actually creating more of binary thinking.
Yeah.
And I think there's something really substantial in that I don't think is really accounted for in where the world views or how they've changed so much since then.
I think it's a great concern amongst most therapists and psychologists, whatnot. I interviewed someone who's a professor at a university, and that episode comes out later. And she and I talk about that this new generation, so glued to technology, there's a disconnect from human beings and the natural world. That's very concerning. And I agree with you. It's something that I think scientists and philosophers and everyone else should be looking at very carefully and seeing what we can do to, because I'm all for technology. I mean, thanks to technology, we can talk, you know, but I think somehow we have to figure out how to move forward and merge these two things in a healthy way.
Yeah, there's a sense of balance that's missing. And I feel like for me, like I wasn't really excited about TV. And when I was a kid, like I would prefer to be out in the woods climbing trees and doing that type of thing. And I think that, you know, I find a lot of kids in my life these days are like, wow, I really just want to get home so I can do this latest video game or this, whatever it might be. And even like research, it's like research is different now than it was in the 60s and 70s, and how, you know, you would have to engage differently. And even in books, you would have a lot more relationship with libraries and books. And yeah, we can get everything on the internet. You can go to grandmother Google and ask anything. And yet there's something about the cognitive pathways of research that helps us develop our critical thinking. And I think a lot of that is also under siege right now, because everything is just kind of handed to us, rather than having good mentors asking us good questions to lead us to our edges of learning and understanding.
I couldn't agree more. We were fortunate enough. My dad bought us a set of encyclopedias. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell. I tell people, you don't know the number of times a week I would go to the encyclopedia to look something up, to learn something.
Me too.
Me too.
Yeah, very, very. And you would then get into the thing of, well, how old are yours? You know, like our newest one, we have the latest update. Yeah. That was like the latest technology was, you know, the latest Encyclopedia Britannica, you know. So much time is spent inside now with kids. And I think that's also very influential when I talk about sensory input. You know, they're in rooms that are flat and right angles, and you know, every doorway is measured where you can walk through without even thinking. The floors are flat, so you don't think about tripping. And there's a lessening, I think, of children's ability to actually navigate diversity that's come from that sensory input that's been so minimized. Mm. And so like with kids in programs that we've run when we're out doing a creek walk, who are like tough kids, they play football, they do all this stuff, but they've never been off a manicured surface out of the city. And you bring them out to do creek walking up through rocks and they could hardly walk. And I feel there's a piece missing that our physicality actually informs some of our neural pathways. And how we're physical also, you know, it informs how these connections make. And I think there's a piece missing there as well. Mm. And that's some of the impetus of why we started Wilderness Youth Project.
Tell me about the youth project. I'd like to hear more.
Yeah. So I was working in a homeless shelter for families in Santa Barbara, California. And I was doing children's programs and volunteer coordinating. And my wife and I were doing training with one of the top trackers in the world, Tom Brown Jr., who wrote the book, The Tracker. If you have kids out there and you want to get them interested in the natural world, get them the book, The Tracker by Tom Brown Jr. It's such an inspiring book. And we found out that he was still teaching. And so we started training with him for about 4 years. And so we'd learn all these survival skills and all sorts of different things. And tracking was a big one as well. And so during that time, we would come back from those trainings and then we would see if any of the kids at the homeless shelter wanted to go into the mountains for the weekend, and we'd get permissions from their families so the kids could get out and we'd go do all these things with these kids. And that we found, like, kids would come back, you know, being in a homeless shelter with their parents and, you know, mostly single moms with their kids. And we would bring the kids back from these weekends. They say, "Mom, we don't have to live here anymore. We can live in a debris hut in the mountains," you know? And I'm like, well, you know, not so much, but there was an empowerment that happened.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
That also we saw an awakening of, in muscle memory, like an ancestral muscle memory in kids. Doing things that their ancestors did awakened something in them. So we would have kids from opposing gangs and like all these different situations that were coming through these programs. But out there in the natural world, there was such a humbling kind of, I don't know, level playing field, so to speak, for everybody there. Nature didn't treat anybody differently, no matter the color of your skin. Nature doesn't treat you differently by how much money you have, what size your house is, or if you even have a house. But nature has this beautiful way of teaching equanimity. I saw this, and my wife saw this with these kids, and one thing led to another, and we decided through some generosity of some people in the community to get this project started called Wilderness Youth Project, and that was in the late 90s. And now it's, you know, well over 20 years it's been in operation, and it's one of the most successful youth programs in Santa Barbara County.
That's cool.
It's all premised on facilitating nature awareness inside of us and around us with children, and doing it in a way that's fun. I mean, it's that simple.
And do the kids camp out in tents and stuff when they do this?
So that, or they build huts or whatever. The, you know, there's after school programs. We're actually in schools all over Santa Barbara County, teaching a lot of these skills out back of the schoolhouse, and doing trips up trails. And then we have weekends, and then we have expeditions. And it's an amazing group of people who are utilizing a lot of work by one of our friends and teachers, a man named John Young, who wrote The Coyote's Guide to Nature Awareness and Mentoring, basically about how to mentor children in nature. And he was one of our influences, and Tom Brown and many other teachers in our life. And a lot of those teachings are still embedded in the core curriculum of that program. And that is what kind of led into, for me, into the world of permaculture as well.
So let's talk about permaculture. Yeah. For those who don't know, I'm going to read the quote from Bill Mollison, that it was defined as, quote, "the conscious design and maintenance of agriculturally productive systems which have the diversity, stability, and resilience of natural ecosystems. It is the harmonious integration of the landscape with people, providing their food, energy, shelter, and other material and non-material needs in a sustainable way." So let's boil that down into layman's terms. Can you explain permaculture for the general population?
Well, it's a design science for regenerative human settlement that mimics natural systems to create that stability and resilience that Bill Mollison was talking about. It is nothing more than a design science. People think it's gardening. People think it's gray water systems, natural building. All of those are a part of the things that get designed in permaculture, but the core, the spine of what permaculture is a design methodology that can be applied to every aspect of life. It's about how do you take some aspect or need that you have in your human settlement needs, and then design it to work with the natural patterns on that landscape. It's that simple.
So you're saying, an example, I go to New England and I buy 40 acres of land, and I'm now going to build a house on that land. Before I build, I should consult a permaculture person who, or someone schooled in permaculture like yourself, to say, how do I design this home to be working with the natural landscape, with the flow of the water underground, with the sun where it's hitting for optimal gardening? Is it all that kind of things?
Yeah, you know, and I think you could even say right where you're sitting, it's like looking, you probably, it's what, in the afternoon right now, you're probably, your window's facing west there, isn't it? Because it's, you have your blinds closed.
This window faces east. It's reflecting off the other side of the building and hitting this window. Okay. That's why you're seeing so much light. Yeah.
So that's one of the things I would look at in just window placement is, okay, if I'm living in Southern California, I would be really cautious to have a window that's facing west, because what would happen is in that building, you would have a heat gain that would have you to have to adjust for it during the hot months, which are the most difficult part of being in Southern California, I think, are the hot months.
Yeah.
Where they can get really uncomfortable. And so then oftentimes that drives air conditioning units and excessive energy usage. So it's looking at the systems around you. So you wouldn't put your refrigerator next to a window that's on the west side. And so you're just thinking through all of the needs of the system you live in relation to what's happening in the natural world. Unfortunately, many of the modern infrastructure designers discount nature, and they say, okay, well, we won't, yeah, it doesn't matter. This is the best view. Let's put the window here. But then you have now excessive energy costs because of that for the lifetime of the building. So that's, you know, it's not just about the 40-acre piece. It's also about designing your ice cream shop for the most efficiency. So you can use that same thinking to a lot of different settings. But yes, I would say if you're, or even better than hiring a permaculture designer, I would say that you go and do a permaculture design certification course and learn how to design that land yourself.
Ah.
That's one of the the beauties of the permaculture movement is that there's a multitude of design courses that can be done both on site and online globally.
I know that there's the 12 principles of permaculture that I, when I did my research about it, and I'm wondering, have those principles changed over time, or are they still the same?
Well, those there were two founding folks who of the permaculture movement, Bill Mollison and David Holmgren. The 12 principles were distilled versions of many more principles that Bill Mollison had hypostulated, and he put them into 12 concise principles. So David Holmgren, one of the other founders, the younger founding member and the one who's still alive, came up with those. And I think it's great. I think what you have to do is step back and look at the bigger picture, though, is where did those come from? They weren't just out of the brains of these people. What they were observations in nature. They were saying, how does nature regenerate its landscape? What are the principles that are there? How do native indigenous cultures who have survived and thrived in the same place for thousands of years, what are the common principles in their methodologies that we can draw from in a universal way so they can apply globally? Huh. So they came from natural worlds and they came from people who are harmonizing in the natural world with their systems and then coupled with good science.
How is permaculture different than industrial agriculture?
One is that permaculture is a design science, like I said earlier. It's not a form of agriculture.
Right.
It leads to a type of agriculture that looks different than conventional agriculture, hugely different. Because if you look at conventional agriculture, it still is nature. Like you're still working with soils, you're still working with soil microbes, you're still working with sunlight, you're still working with hydrological cycles. And people that say, oh yeah, well, you know, conventional agriculture is not natural, you know, it's not based on anything natural. Well, it totally uses natural systems. So what happens is you see a degradation of the system through time. So in a lot of the Green Revolution, which is often the term used to coin conventional agriculture, you see over time, you see the soil resources get depleted, you see signs of erosion happen, you see the degradation of growing cycles within the plant. So production starts to reduce and you start to see a need for more inputs. But the more inputs you do doesn't mean the more production is at the same level of what you put into it. And so you see this debt cycle develop. And it's the conventional system to me is not very productive. Mm. If you look from a caloric standpoint, on average, conventional agriculture takes 10 calories of energy to produce one calorie of food. You have to spend more energy than you actually harvest. And to me, that's not sustainable. It's not, and not even close to being regenerative. There's a professor, Steve Moore, who he's done some incredible studies on energy inputs and outputs of regenerative systems designed using permaculture and agroecology. He's been able to produce 36 calories of food with one calorie of input.
Oh, wow.
And so here you have this complete flipping of the story. And it is a misnomer to even say that, you know, without this modern agriculture, we would not have food for the world. What's happening is food is being depleted from the world because this centralized agriculture system is actually stealing from the very biodiverse local indigenous systems. They're actually being pushed out to where, you know, now most farmers are having to do export systems. They don't even grow the food they need to support themselves and their families.
So does this lead into the kind of thing I hear about where people say, like, we're growing as a world, we're growing the wrong crops in the wrong places. Like there are certain places where almonds would grow better than they do. And, you know, and also I've heard people who talk about permaculture say another component of it is that you don't necessarily grow an entire field of almonds. You mix it up with almonds and other things that together,
yeah,
scientifically create a much more homogenous and better life, yeah, for the soil and things, yeah, like that.
So, you know, I always say look to nature. You know, does nature do a monocrop of even oaks?
No.
You know, you look out behind me, there's oak, there's manzanita, there's pine, there's, you know, different poplars. There's a lot of different types of trees here. You never find in nature a singular plant, even in a prairie. you can get 200 species within, you know, a 1,000 meter square. You can get 200 species of different types of grasses and microflora, so to speak. So in nature, you don't have that. There's a stability in having a biodiverse system. The problem with industrial agriculture is it's hard to run a machine through a system that isn't a monocrop. So where that machine's, the physicality of that machine can't work with a huge diversity in the landscape. So you get this loss of ability to use machines. Well, you know, and that's where a lot of conventional agriculturists say, well, then see, then this justifies it. And what I say, and what the research shows us, is it's just the opposite of that. Is what it tells us is that we're more productive with smaller farms. So in Russia today, they provide over half their food in farms that are 1 acre or 1 hectare or less. So less than 2.5 acres. So over 50% of the food in entire Russia is provided by these dashas, they're called. And they're one of the most stabilizing effects within the Russian culture right now, where America, we are so centralized that we actually have a lot of vulnerability right now because we've decentralized, or we've actually centralized our food systems, and we no longer have local stability. And so part of the movement that permaculture supports is relocalization of a lot of our primary production and primary services so that we have more stability in our local bioregion. I'm working on this very thing right now, just so you know. I'm developing for USAID, I'm developing a agroecological market farm guidance manual, basically helping to guide their programs away from the market farm that's doing monocropping to these very diverse farms that provide income year-round rather than just once a year when one crop comes in. And if anything happens to that crop, that farmer may not be able to feed his family that year.
So, if you had ultimate control of money and power and resources, and we decided to go ahead and do this the way you're talking about, and there was a bunch of these small farms, does that mean that it converts over back to a manual labor system of people actually working the field?
There's different ways to approach it. So there's different levels. Like in agroecology, there's different levels of intervention, so to speak, from where we are with the conventional agriculture systems that are prominent right now. And so some levels are just like adding edge plantings, doing what we call alley cropping. So you have some perennials moving through and then having your regular monocrop in between this more biodiverse system. So there's gradations of change that can happen very easily. Now, the most profitable farms in America are under 60 acres. People are like, what? And that's per acre. So most profit per acre. And also one of the most profitable farms in all of America from that standpoint is a man named Joel Salatin, who has written many books around basically how do you do production farming for a greater, a little larger than your community, but your region. And he's written several books. There's been a lot of young farmers super inspired by him because he's using permaculture. He's using integrative thinking. He's using natural patterns. Like, so for example, he'll have his cattle will go out and they'll graze on a particular piece of land. He'll keep them very close together. So he calls it mob stocking, which is how herds of animals protect themselves in nature. So it's a natural pattern of cattle. And then after they move through, 3 days later, he brings in his chickens. And the chickens then come in and they scratch the manure open. And the maggots from the flies are just before pupation at 4 days. So he waits specifically 3 days so the maggots get big for the flies, and then the chickens have this huge meal, and then they spread the manure to help the grasses come back. So he pulses them on the grasses. And now over many, many years of having a high production cattle farm and chicken production system, his land is healthier than it was than when he started.
Wow, that's cool.
Which is just the opposite in conventional agriculture. Now in Africa, when you're out in the savannah, you see ungulates, so the cloven-hoofed animals, so the animals like the cattle who are out there in herds moving very close together, and following them are birds doing the exact same thing. And I just think it's a really interesting when you start to watch, well, how is nature doing this? And then how can we bring this back in a realistic way that's very productive? So the work with USAID is really right now is around what is a practical way to create this agro ecosystem in a market farm. So, and create more stability for a farmer. Because one of the things that conventional farming also does is it diminishes the buffer in the landscape to extreme conditions. So as we're moving into a time of more, you know, as climate weirding is happening even more and more, and land degradation is happening more and more, which they work together. Most of the effects we feel are because the buffer is gone in the landscape. And so when you remove the buffer of the stability of the hydrological cycles, the tree systems, the vegetation, the soil microbial web of life that's there, you disable the ability of that landscape to buffer a flood or a drought.
Well, that's that video that I saw you sent me where you guys went to Kenya, I think it was Kenya, and you redesigned.
Yeah.
Uganda. Sorry. Yeah. So you guys, the video I saw, you guys went to Uganda and you rerouted some of the land in order to create this dam to hold this water and create this buffer so that even in the dry season, the ground would have water, correct?
Yeah. And also to mitigate the effects of erosion. Because, you know, when you have erosion too, which a lot of the, you know, conventional farming always leads to erosion. It's amazing how that happens. And what happens when you have an eroding landscape is you lose your nutrient base. And it also stresses the soil microbiology. And if your soil microbiology is not healthy, your plants will not be healthy. They'll be stressed. And the stress leads to disease and pests infiltrating what you have. And then you have to add chemicals. You know, it's like this self-defeating cycle. And I feel like it's exciting to actually be on this edge of redesigning for regenerative human settlement patterns and to be able to design agriculture systems that work in the markets. They work for markets, but they also work for being in touch with that which sustains you and having the nutrient base that you need near you.
Right.
And so the other part of the localization of the food systems and also a lot of our services and primary production and processing is that the longer you keep a dollar in your community, the more it can help your community. So as soon as you export your produce, you're exporting the water from your community. You know, one of the biggest exports in all of Australia is water because of the crops that they export. And so you have this, you know, a water deficient continent exporting its water, and nobody counts that into the export cost, the true cost. If we were to do true costing of conventional agriculture right now, we couldn't afford it.
Interesting.
It's only reason it's making it is that it's subsidized.
And I want to ask you about the politics of that in just a second, but I wanted to, just because I think it's important to have the other side have a voice. When I emailed you, I sent you Curtis Stone from the urbanfarmer.co has this quote, and he said, permaculture doesn't work. And the reason is that agriculture does not exist in nature. It's a man-made system. As much as we'd like it to reflect aspects of nature, it can only to a small degree, because in order for a food system to be dependable, it needs to produce predictable yields on a consistent basis. Otherwise, it can't scale. Now, from everything you're saying, it sounds like obviously you disagree with him, and I would disagree with him as well, based upon what you just told me. But I'd love to hear your feedback on that.
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody has their, you know, their own way of viewing things. And first thing I would say is that, you know, him saying that it's not a natural system is not correct. It's completely dependent on the ecology in which it's based in. So the other thing is the predictability. Sure, for one crop, you might be able to predict a certain amount, but also with the degradation of the systems, there's so much losses that are occurring in those systems. There's less stability in it. So if you have a farming system that has 20 different varieties of different species of both annuals and perennials, if you have one crop that's affected by a certain pest, or you have one crop affected by an unusual weather event, you don't lose everything. And so part of the stability of permaculturally designed system is that it's looking for opportunities that agricultural system could take advantage of in relationship to the ecology of the context of the site. So I get called by conventional agriculture folks saying, how can I, you know, I've got a lot of erosion and it's killing me. It's costing me so much.
Yeah.
And I come in and say, well, there's some simple things you can do. So let's change the way that you're furrowing your land so that they work with the contours. And they'd never thought of that. The contour of the land is a natural pattern. Just by doing that, we were able to raise their productivity 10% in a monocrop. That's permaculture. So it's not, one of the things that happens with the word permaculture is that it gets relegated to how it's been expressed rather than what it is.
Right, right.
And so you get a lot of people who are doing, you know, amazing systems or their systems that weren't done well, you know, that they weren't, they were like, oh yeah, we're just going to plant everything. And that, you know, gets out on the internet. And yet there's a lot of systems that we've been working with for years and years and years that are just super profitable, super productive, very relevant to the modern food systems and the way that our market systems work right now.
Warren, let me ask you, if someone is listening to this podcast and they go, man, this sounds so awesome, I want to learn more about this, what's the first thing they should do to learn more about permaculture?
What I would do is I would do, one, look at some podcasts that are permaculture related. There's also some online courses. Quail Springs is just coming up. We're filming an online course here coming up later this month. We're going to be filming a lot of it. But there's Jeff Lawton has, with the Permaculture Research Institute, has some wonderful online courses. Andrew Millison with Oregon State University has a very reputable, very good academic program of permaculture. I would also find a group in your area. So look up on the internet and see who is doing permaculture in your area and just go and hang out. Of course, when COVID is, you know, do your social distancing or you know, as things change. But I would find other people who are doing it and see what they're doing and what they're experiencing.
Now, question for people like myself who live in a condo or an apartment and whatnot, does permaculture affect our lives? Like if we want to put a garden on our balcony, is that something we should consider?
I think you should always grow something to stay sane, you know, even if it's just one tomato plant in your south-facing window. I have a friend, Natalie Topa, who lives in Nairobi, and she lives on the fifth floor of an apartment building, and she has what she calls the fifth floor farm. On her balcony, she's raising chickens, she's got worm systems, she grows fungi, she's got vegetables everywhere. And she grows a significant portion of her food on the fifth floor of her city apartment.
That's amazing.
And it's there's so much out there written about urban permaculture, we call it.
Oh, no. When I grew up in Ohio, we always had a garden. And we grew everything from zucchini to sunflowers to tomatoes, all this stuff.
Yeah.
And we would just open up the sliding glass door to the backyard, go out, get an onion and two zucchini and chop them up fresh and have dinner, you know. And I really miss that living in a city. So
I love Bill Mollison. He said something that really stuck with me. He said, all the problems of the world can be solved in the garden. And I really have thought about that over the years, you know, that it's, you know, that like maybe it can minimize a lot of problems, maybe not solve all the problems of the world, but certainly it would change how a lot of the types of problems that we have in the world, because we're no longer in touch with that which sustains us. And I feel that it's, if moving forward, that for me would be one of the best things in the world that we could do is to, everybody has a garden. And I know that would change how even the wars that are going on, that, you know, it wouldn't be the same thing if we changed all our supply lines and all of that. So I don't discount the garden as just this fad thing that you do on the side. I feel like it's actually an instrumental part of being human.
That's beautiful.
I think we've always done that. And it's a natural part of being human.
Warren, what's the most challenging thing about what you do?
You know, a lot of the work in refugee camps has really awakened something in me of the plight of humanity right now and the displacement that's going on that, you know, many Americans don't really feel that, but globally, it's so prominent. And I feel like this idea of us not having our umbilical in the ground in a place is something devastating to the human heart. And I feel that so many people are being pushed away from the place where their umbilical is in the ground by warfare, politics, the effects, so many of the effects of conventional agriculture has caused famine around Africa. And that's well documented. There's a great study by the UN that talks about how the Green Revolution has failed Africa, and it's actually causing more people to be hungry than when there was traditional agriculture practices in place. And so for me, that's one of the hardest things that's out there. And just people not caring about where the things that they need to survive come from. And is it coming from equitable places? Is it coming from, you know, was someone displaced so I could have these jeans that I'm wearing?
Yeah.
You know, was there an indigenous people who were cleared off the land so the cotton can be grown and the chemicalification?
I mean, look, I'm holding up my iPhone right now so listeners can see that. Yeah, they don't realize how many people's lives are negatively affected so they can have the latest iPhone.
You know, Tantalum, and all of the craziness in Congo is a failed state right now because of cell phones and I mean it's hugely influential as the mining industry that has to do with some of the things that have to do with the electronics that are connecting us today. And you know, and it makes me think of then, what do you do with the cell phone? What do you do with this technology that actually offsets that? Are you using it just for gaming? Are you using it just for, you know, just for convenience or entertainment? Or are you doing what you're doing, Daniel? And you're like raising awareness in the world. Are you? And to me, that like there's a justification in that, that, you know, can you help people to actually grow into, you know, living more regeneratively by getting on a plane and going somewhere, or by, you know, using a cell phone. And I think we just have to, be committed to being responsible to our technology and remembering that the technology comes from the natural world in one form or another and has affected people and place all through its supply chain.
Yeah.
You know, some people, they'll come to me and they'll say, oh, you know, I just can't, you know, cities, you know, I can't live in city and cities are so bad. And, you know, what I always remember is that when I go into a city is that there's still like the concrete jungle that's there, the concrete building that's there is still an ancient riverbed that's been mined. And what I go through is I go and I touch the concrete and I say, I remember you, river. Mm. It's like this building was an old river.
That's cool.
This house was an old tree. And when we forget that, we like move through the world with no anchor because we just don't see all that's gone into this. So we have to learn about the things we touch.
I agree.
So it goes back to our research conversation we were having, is that to be responsible in a world and to be able to like live without having to fully and protect your heart from just shattering completely, there's a need to actually research the things that we're touching in the world. How was this book made? You know, what's the process of steel, and what's the history of steel, and like start to know these things. And we get back in touch with that which sustains us. And the more we know about it, the more we can be influential on how it comes to us, and the more we can take responsibility for things. So maybe you'll have a few less tomatoes that you buy from a conventional processor, or for, let's say, like carrots, like, you know, some of the most organic carrots, 70% of the organic carrots in America are grown in one valley in California that only gets about 6 inches of rain a year. And it's overdrafting an aquifer to provide those carrots that are going out all over the country. And that carrot, it has such a high ecological footprint, and it's such, you know, the true cost of it is actually destroying an ecology, but it's an organic carrot.
Mm.
And the thing that we do is we learn that is that, oh, well, maybe I'll find another farmer that's outside of LA that, you know, the next step would be to go to a farmer's market and find someone who doesn't do that in that valley. And then the next step would be to get a garden in your backyard and to do that. And at your place, before you even get a backyard, maybe you have a pot that you grow a few carrots. And even if it's not all your carrots, it's like there's a few that you get there and you get to take complete responsibility for the supply chain of that.
Yeah.
And there's something really beautiful about that. And for me, my belief is that culture comes from place, not from people. that culture originates in a place, but it's our relationship to place. So a group of people, so intact culture comes from a group of people who knows where all that sustains them comes from, and they honor those things deeply. So as you start to create that local system of supplying and being in relationship with that which sustains you, culture will start to come through. So from a, let's say if all your clothes, and I know this is totally unrealistic, but let's say all your clothes came from the natural world within a few miles of you.
Okay.
You know, and you were using scrub brush, the bark from the scrub brush, and you were weaving it together to make your, you know, your loincloth or whatever you're doing. yeah. And you had rabbits, because I know there's rabbits down in LA, and you were making fur with that, and you were doing, you know, possibly deer skins and other types of, you know, maybe there was some growing of some textiles that were there or some wool. What would happen is all the people around you, a group of people who were in touch with that in that area, their clothing would have a certain register or footprint culturally. It would look similarly. The dyes you use would be from plants from that area. So the colors of it would be, you know, shared, and you would start to get a cultural footprint of your clothing that was unique to your place. Same with music and musicality and music instruments, same with food. So for me, culture has never lost.
Mm.
It's just gone back into hiding in the ground, waiting for the germination conditions within the human system to actually help it to sprout again. And to me, it's about relocalization. It's that simple and complicated. Yeah.
Well, speaking of complicated, I actually was going to ask you, how often do you have to navigate politics to get things done?
Mm. It depends on what level of politics. You know, and when I first went to do, I was first invited to do work in Liberia right after the war. We had to meet with the vice president of the country every week we were there. Every trip we were there, we would have to go meet with them and report what we were doing and find what they were needing to do. And, you know, so there was a direct correlation with that. But right now, so much of the politics are actually driven by industrial needs or influences. So even in USAID and a lot of the government programs are driven a lot by markets and the influencers of markets. So the oil industry drives a lot of the aid organizations' work. The chemical industries do. And
you hear all these terrible things about oil industry and all of its, you know, bad influence, but do you, in the field you're in, do you look at it and go, I wish the oil industry wasn't involved? Or are you glad of some of their contributions? Like, where do you stand? I'm just curious.
Yeah. You know, I'm not promoting that we couldn't, with, you know, the billions of people on the earth, go to a system where we were living completely in wild settings. I don't feel that, but I feel like there's an irresponsibility to toxifying the environment.
I agree.
Like, you know, we have a responsibility to our children and our children's 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 children. And we're not doing that based on GDP models. You know, I mean, the whole idea of our benchmark of success is based on gross domestic product. And so if you look at that, that means the more cancer we have and the treatments for cancer, our GDP goes up. The more war we have, our GDP goes up. Now, is that a benchmark of success? And I feel that it's just not, you know, it's showing that these economically driven systems are actually producing poor design. So for example, in Las Vegas, you go to Las Vegas and you see all these tracts of homes there that, you know, there was a huge boon in the industries there that were supporting the building of these houses. One of them was the air conditioning industry. And so, you know, you had houses that were being designed to basically create the need for having to condition the air of the house because it would be not survivable otherwise. And so now you have all these poorly designed houses that aren't working with the influences of sun, with wind patterns, all of these things, which could very simply have been done up front on the front end of these houses. It's not like we don't have the technology to do passive solar. It's like we understand that really well. I mean, it's been proven over and over again, the benefits of it. And now you have this whole system of infrastructure that's built by basically saying we can push away the ecological consequences with oil. We can, you know, with energy. And so now you have this huge amount of energy that's needed to then maintain these. And so there's inefficiencies. All I'm saying is with good design, we're more efficient. And I think that's where we need to go. It's not like we're saying we got to go back. It's like, no, we need to get more efficient. And if you're saying you can ignore the sun and be efficient, I challenge you there, because you can't ignore the sun. You've got to say, where's the path of the sun at the different times of year? And understand how you design your garden, how you design your house, where you park your car. We understand that the benefits of working with sunlight is actually cost saving and material saving and health saving. So it's not like some far left weird thing that's out there saying we've got to design for efficiency. I just think that it's super pragmatic. And I actually call myself a conservative because of it, because I like conserving resources.
Well, how do you feel about things like Standing Rock and the Dakota Access Pipeline? You know, that's another.
Yeah, there's so much grief right now in the world that comes to head in many ways. So there's the issues ecologically, but there's also the issues of colonization that are continuing to happen. And during this time, with all the George Floyd protests and Black Lives Matter protests and, you know, the equitability issues that are not there for so many people, I, as a white older male with so much economic privilege, have to really look at my own life and say, wow, this privilege comes from this track record of racism, and where do I have that in me? And I have to start looking internally of where do I carry that with me?
Yeah.
And how do I transform that into some healing force in the landscape?
Have you come up with anything so far?
You know, it's, for me, a lot of it is about understanding that there is this privilege that I have, that how do I use that to help support those around me that weren't given that? And also, how do I create pathways of listening that doesn't include prejudice at all?
Yeah.
How do I really deeply listen to where you're listening to the lineage behind each one of us? Wherever you come from, whatever that is that we all have this huge lineage of ancestry. So when I see you here, I see this huge group of people behind you, that you are the pinnacle. You are the living representative of every single human being that's ever been in your family line.
Yeah.
And that's like even 20 generations ago, over a million people. So you're this like living representation, and you carry the opportunities, you carry the joys, you carry the grief of all of that. And so how do I hear that in every conversation, no matter who the person is? And can I be present enough to be able to be there with empathy and sympathy, and also to understand that I have a whole set of different stories that's so differing from a person from Minnesota who's being oppressed by the police. I my story is very different, and yet I have family members who experience that with the police regularly because of the tone of their skin. And it's like, there's so much that has to, you know, I have to look and say, okay, is our permaculture courses filled with diversity? So that's another thing. It's like, you know, it's a movement that was formulated by two white males. And so is the movement of permaculture, is it being inclusive? Is it moved to a place where now it's creating opportunities for people of all backgrounds in the movement? And the permaculture movement has a great need to grow that area.
Yeah.
And I'm the first to admit it.
One of the ways in which I think is beautiful that feeds into what you're saying is, it's not about taking on the responsibility of trying to heal the entire planet. It's taking on the idea that you should do what you can in your corner of the world. And like you spoke earlier about, are you going to use this phone for something constructive? Are you going to, you know, so, and I really do believe, and maybe I'm an eternal optimist, but I believe if every human being stopped for a minute, went out to nature and took a moment to breathe and said, how can I do my part to heal the world through love? This planet would become the coolest place to live ever in the history of the universe, you know?
I love your optimism and your vision for that. You know, I feel one of the biggest, at the core of this is grief. I believe the core of the human experience is grief-driven. And I see grief as a natural part of being human, meaning not depression, but grief. Depression actually comes from unexpressed grief. Grief, I mean, is simply stated as you lose something you love. Like you truly love something and you've lost it. So like when my dad died, that's so human, you know?
Yeah.
And the grief that comes out of that is something that's really, it's an authentic part of how you grow as a human. And I believe that it's a muscle inside of you, this grief muscle that has to be expressed. And in one range of motion, it's like this weeping and tears and the retching and the, you know, that feeling of the just loss on such a deep level. And that can be for a place, that could be for a tree, that could be for the storytellers in your tribe were murdered by the colonialists coming through, that, you know, this deep grief. But on the other range of motion of that same muscle is our capacity for joy and our capacity for praising the world is the same muscle. So you ever cry so hard you laugh, or you laugh so hard you cry?
Oh yeah.
That same muscle. And so the like young men who are told not to cry also have a hard time praising the world and showing joy. So there's this piece of it, that this grief that's there, that need, that culturally we have suppressed that, the movement of grief. And what happens, you talk to one of our teachers in our lives, Martin Prechtel, speaks and writes about his time in the villages of the Tutuhil Mayan in the highlands of Guatemala. And he speaks of how there the elders share that when you have grief that's unexpressed as a collective of people, that it becomes depression. And when you get a lot of depression in people, it becomes warfare. And it's something that it's warfare where it's against yourself and the world around you. And I feel that a lot of our commerce even today has moved into this place of warfare. Like if you train at Harvard Business School, you learn war tactics. That's one of the trainings you learn, is you learn war tactics. There's certain books that they read that are part of that. One of my friends who went through that, and they literally teach war tactics in business. And it's like, I feel like there is this great unexpressed grief that keeps jumping from generation to generation. And if you look at the Black Lives Matter movement, it's really about trying to get that grief expressed in a way so that it can become a life-giving force. And so I really feel like there's this ancestral grief that's not dealt with. And we no longer have the cultural mechanisms like the Tutuhil Mayan recognize this. And they had great grief rituals. And it's something that I feel is a really important way forward for us, is our ability to actually find healthy ways to express our grief. So weeping for the world, weeping for our ancestors. And depression also leads to, as we know, it leads to addiction. Mm-hmm. And so here we have in America, one of the most addictive societies in the history of humanity. And I feel like it's a direct, I don't know, if you correlate all of it, it comes back to the causal pieces of it is the unexpressed grief. And this whole kind of the movement of people going out on the streets, to me, is a collective way of expressing grief. I think some ways it turns to violence. You don't want grief expression to go violent.
Agreed.
Literally, you look at indigenous cultures all over the world, in Australia, in Europe, in the Americas, in Africa, in Asian countries. Every country, indigenous peoples had that in common in their tribes, is they had grief rituals. So that tells you, if it's expressing itself globally, that there's something innate to it. And I think that's something worth looking into. And so working your hands in the garden, for me, is a way that I can actually start to move things in my body, and weeping and putting my tears in the garden. You know, when we get to causal things, I think so many of the things we've been talking about are symptomatic, but I think the causes come back to this things like grief.
If I gave you unlimited money and permission to make whatever changes you wanted to any political policy worldwide, you have now like omnipotent powers here. What would be the first three things you would do or put into place for the world?
Oh boy, that's dangerous. I would change all political systems should be watershed based.
Explain.
Meaning the politics should follow ecology. Mm. So the boundaries of politics would be driven by the ecologies in which they rest. So if you find your ability to create or to diminish a landscape would be in the landscape that affects you politically. the explorer Powell. Lake Powell is named after him. When he came back from this expedition, I think it was Ulysses S. Grant was president, he drew a map of how the states of the United States should follow watersheds. And you can look it up online. It's really fascinating because he was saying that our political boundaries should be that. And there's a huge indigenous movement around changing the politics based on watersheds. And I believe that that would change things. The other thing would be is that I would disable subsidies of things that aren't life-giving. So poor agricultural practices should not be given money to keep it alive. I think we should subsidize things that are regenerative and we should tax what is toxic. And I think I would develop as a part of that a really a series of principles that basically it's like a questioning tree of, is this regenerative or not? And if it's not, it's not subsidized. And if it's toxic, if it actually has negative effects, it would be taxed.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. And the other would be, it would be something to do with not just the preservation of natural landscapes, but it would be the integration of humans in natural landscapes. Mm. I don't believe that conserving a landscape means humans should be off of it. I feel like we have a part of us that is actually, we have opposable thumbs because we have been stewards of a landscape as a species. There's so much history of humans being tenders of landscape where humans were, for thousands of years, the ecologies were actually better than the natural environments that were there. Even though most people who come into that thought it was all natural. There's a book in California called Tending the Wild. And it speaks of the California native peoples and how they tended the landscape in a way that actually brought more biodiversity and more abundance. And when they were killed and oppressed and pulled out, the landscapes went back to being natural, but they were less vital.
Interesting.
And I feel like our gift is stewardship. So enabling that in people and policy would be my third thing.
What are some ways that you think people can practice sustainability at home that they may not be aware of?
Tracking what sustains you. What are the things that are sustaining you? Do you know where your energy is coming from? Are you tracking that? You can find that out. You can actually find where your Southern California Edison is buying for your area. Where is it coming through? Is there choices that you can make? Are there ways that you can be more efficient with your energy use? So one is efficiency. Two is like looking at all of the things that are material in your life and just saying, you know, before you get something is, do I even need this? But then, you know, is it something that's really needed, and is it something that causes a lot of damage, or do I not know, or can I buy it more locally, or can I make it? So trying to get more in relationship with that which sustains you, I think, is really important. And that can, you know, it's like learning to make your own sourdough bread. You know, I think I saw a meme, or someone told me about a meme that was going around, is now that people can't go and watch sports and all that stuff, men are making sourdough bread. And I'm like, you know, what a great way to, you know, that actually highlights something about being in relationship with something that's sustaining you is, you know, and then the next step would be to find a flower source that you actually have a relationship with. You know, there's a group of heritage breed flowers up in the Tehachapis that are selling flour that is grown with heritage breed seeds in a good way, in a regenerative way. And it's like, find one thing though, because it's overwhelming. If you look around you, you'd be like, I can't, like my shirt, I don't know where the cotton was grown. Oh no, you know, I don't know where this was made or that. Take one thing and take it to its source. And just change that one thing. Learn to make your own toothpaste or you know, just find one thing. Like, even if it's you only grow one tomato a year, that's one tomato you have a relationship with. And then, you know, look at ways of conserving, you know, if you can walk somewhere. And I mean, it's like grow something in your life.
Yes.
If it doesn't matter if you're in, you know, like a high rise, you can grow in a window. I think it'll save your soul.
That's beautifully, beautifully, beautifully put. If you were to summarize for all the people listening to this podcast, what is the most important thing that you want to impart to people?
I think that each one of us has been given a gift at the beginning of time, the very beginning of time. In all the history of humanity, there's not been a single person that has the gifts that you have, Daniel. Not the single person in all of history. And in all the future generations, may there be many, that there won't be one person that has the gifts and the vision that you carry in the world, that the world has for you and that you have within you. And so if I was to impart one thing with people is that it is our responsibility to discover that within ourselves, but also within those close around us. Because oftentimes it's someone outside of us that recognizes it first in us as our gifts, and to nurture that and to express it into the world. And the world is less whole, Daniel, if you don't express your gifts. If I don't express my gifts, the world is less whole. So we have a responsibility in our family circles, in our community circles, to actually help people discover their gifts, where we all are needed in the world. And I feel that if everybody is stepping into their gifts, then great global change will happen.
Well, and it's interesting because in answering that question, you answered three or four of my other questions, which is amazing. So thank you. I'm curious, do you think that the human race is going to survive? I mean, do you think we have a bright future? Are you optimistic?
It's possible that humanity will survive. But we're in a time where in these few generations that we're in right now have, in I think in the first time in history, the choice to whether that will happen or not. I think it's not just about humanity. It's about all our non-human brothers and sisters as well. And,
agreed.
And how we have to, it's like we can't keep stealing from our grandchildren to feed ourselves today. We just can't.
Yeah.
And so we have to make some really big choices coming up, which means drastic changes. Keeping going with conventional agriculture could bring us to the brink, because of the degradation that it's doing and the climate issues that are going on. The toxicity issue may kill us. It's the, you know, the war machine may kill us all. I don't know that, but my hope is that as we step into our gifts, we'll actually see how to express them in a life-giving way. And I think that's what a question we all need to ask of each other. Is what I'm doing life-giving, or is it, am I taking more calories than I'm contributing back to the world,
yeah,
so to speak?
That's a great way to put it, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we've talked so much about all these wonderful issues, and thank you for being such a wonderful human being, such an open person,
thank you.
And obviously brilliant. I really love talking with you, and I may have you back for a future episode as well.
Well, lovely.
But before we end, I actually would like to ask you some personal questions. When you're not off helping save the world, what do you do with your spare time?
I have the most wonderful wife in the whole wide world, and we're just up on our 30 years now together. And we love to just be together. And one of the things we love to do is sailing. We love sailing. We love working with our hands. So making felting, you know, doing felting of wool. We love spinning wool. I love working with copper and copper smithing. I love tracking. I love cooking. So that's another thing, is that I cook more often than my wife when I'm home from my trips. And she's really gracious that way to share the kitchen with me. And I love tending the garden. And so we're loving this time right now that I'm glad COVID corresponded with the emergence of spring, because it was perfect time to, you know, I think more gardens were built because of the time that it came into being. But that's, you know, that's a big part of my love of life, is really working with my hands to create things. And I love music as well.
What kind of music do you like?
So I love music from all over the world. So I have this huge collection of just different types of music from around the world. And it just feeds my soul to listen to those, but also play a little bit of the mandolin. And my wife's an incredible musician, and it's a big part of our life, is, you know, plant seeds and sing songs.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, Warren, I know we've touched on spirituality a little bit. What actually does spirituality mean to you?
Boy, it's kind of the question of the ages in a way, isn't it? Mm-hmm. For me, that there's a few things that are considerations. One is that I, like, when I die, I want somebody to cry for me. And so my life is about living in a way where people will cry for you.
Well, have you heard that American Indian proverb that says, when you were born, you cried and the world rejoiced. So live a life that when you die, the world cries and you rejoice.
Yeah. And there's a lot of depth in that, is that in a lot of indigenous cultures, the belief is that your spirit, when you die, can't get to becoming a life-giving force until you're cried for. And what happens is the people who aren't cried for become ghosts. And so they then haunt people, but it's not like what we see on Ghostbusters necessarily, but I do believe there is some of that where they're more manifestations and things, but they become a force that actually inhabits other people with their grief. And so you see in a lot of, statistically, a lot of, like, the youngest in a family will carry the family grief. Not always the case, but they often are the ones, the youngest will carry more of the addiction in the family because they're grief stricken. And they're carrying the ancestral grief. So for me, part of my spirituality is how I live. Am I living in a way that really you're being cried for and you're being wept for at that time, so that I could become a life-giving force rather than a ghost? And for some reason, that settles well with me. And the other is that being a gift giver in the world. So, you know, when we pump water from our well here on the land, that we give gifts that we make with our hands, little shell beads, and we put them over there and we say thank you to the water. And we make blessings on the world rather than take blessings from the world all the time. Mm. And recognizing that we're in debt to the world that's feeding us. You know, you can be in the most, the most urban environment, you're still being fed by multiple ecologies around the world. You're being fed by nature.
Yeah.
And so, even the farm tractor and the chemicals that are going on some of those foods are still parts of nature. You know, they're just remanufactured in different ways or restructured.
Well, the metal of my microphone stand that you're looking at right now, this was an ore that came from the earth. It's just been reshaped.
Yeah, so it's a mountain. And it's like you recognize in that, it's like I say hello to the mountain. Somehow that recognition to me is a spiritual awakening.
That's awesome. I'm curious, are you afraid of dying?
I'm not afraid of dying per se. I am deeply curious about what happens after my last breath, though.
Hmm.
And that I'm driven to not waste a single breath. And I think for me, as I'm more scared of, frightened of living a life I wasn't destined for than actually of dying.
After you're gone, let's say one day your children and grandchildren decide to listen to this podcast and hear your voice or see the video. Is there anything you'd like to say to them in the future?
You are now a living representative of my life as well. And I'm so thankful for that, that literally I become a part of my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. And then those that will never see me, that may my life somehow have been life-giving for theirs. That's my goal, even though, you know, I feel like a lot of our generation has really let them down. And I feel like, you know, I want them to know that there are those like ourselves that are trying our best to make those changes.
Yeah.
Because they're so desperately needed, and that we remember them, that there's faces, you know, when I do a meeting that's really important to me with many people, I'll leave an empty chair for the ancestors and an empty chair for the future generations.
I think that's beautiful.
And just to remember them as we make decisions. And I think it's like they have to have a seat at the table in every decision we make that impacts them. Yeah, love you. That's what I would say.
Warren, the last thing I do with every podcast guest, and thank you.
Yeah.
But the last thing I do is a game called 299 Philosophical and Life Questions with Moonbird. And I basically have a list here of 299 cool questions I've compiled over the years. You pick two numbers.
Okay.
And I will randomly, and I'll read you those two questions.
Okay. So 201.
201.
Yep. And the other is 14.
201. If you won $5,000 right now, what would you do with it?
I would give it to an orphanage in Ethiopia called Euradis Village, who's doing some of the most amazing work. One of the only orphanages in all of Ethiopia that works with disabled children. Mm. And they are extraordinarily good at what they do. They have 110 10 children there, and they're sheltering them all in place during COVID, but they have over 50 of them are babies.
Wow.
And most of them are disabled, and I would just pass that money right over.
That's great. Mm. Number 14, would you consider yourself to be successful?
Hmm. I would. I would say that there are a lot of successes in my life. I guess that's a different way of terming successful. I don't know about being successful, but I've had a lot of successes in my life. And I've had a lot of really beautiful failures that have led me to where I need to go.
Yes.
And so I don't want to discount that. And I really, you know, I'm really humbled by the failures in a way that helped me to be a success. And I love thinking of, you know, the root of the word humble is also the root of the word humility, and the root of the word humus, which is the, you know, the base resource that grows all of life, where we all come from humus and we'll return to the humus someday. And and humor. And I think it's like that to me right there is just, if I can master some of those things, I would see myself as a success.
Warren Brush, I can't thank you enough for being here today. It has been a fantastic, fantastic time talking with you, and I see you.
Thank you.
And I appreciate you very much.
Thank you, Daniel, and it's been an honor to be here with you, and I hope some of these words find a home for those that have one for it. So may I'm always grateful for these opportunities. So thank you so much. And you keep finding your next best step.
Thank you. And have a great day.
Yeah, you too.
If you'd like to learn more about Warren and the incredible organizations he's involved with, please check out quailsprings.org, permaculturedesign.us, and wildernessawareness.org. Until next time, if you'd like more Moonbird in your life, and hey, who wouldn't? Head on over to memoriesofamoonbird.com or visit me on social media at memoriesofamoonbird. Are you wearing your mask? Stay safe.